This is Battalion Chief Mike Myers with the FDNY, and you're listening to the Firefighter Toolbox Internet Radio Show, the go-to place for becoming a better firefighter and leader.
Great firefighters and leaders aren't born, they're built. This is the Firefighter Toolbox Internet Radio Show, the place where better firefighters and leaders are being built.
Respond to a report of firefighters wanting to take their firefighting and leadership skills to the next level.
Firefighter Toolbox en route. Now, with the command...
David J. Solar.
All right, this is David J. Solar. Welcome back to another episode. It is an honor to have you here, and we're en route, obviously, to another awesome lesson right here today. You know, one of the things that we have been dealing with or hearing about is how to approach certain situations and specialty situations, and we've been having some talk on our Facebook page about this hoarding and people that have excessive amounts of stuff, let's say, in their house. And some people are clinically diagnosed as hoarders. And so I invited Ryan Penitting on for us to learn about hoarding. What does it mean for us as firefighters? And maybe what are the top 3 to 4 to 5 things that we need to be aware of in case we do come upon these situations? Now, let me tell you a little bit about Ryan. Ryan Penitting is a firefighter paramedic for the Charleston Fire Department in Charleston, West Virginia. He is currently assigned to Station 8 and is a part of the West Virginia Task Force 1 USAR team. He has over 17 years of combined fire, rescue, and EMS experience. Ryan started with a local volunteer department and continued through EMS to spend 5 years as a critical care paramedic. Ryan transferred to the Career Fire Service in 2003 and has worked for the City of Charleston since 2007. Ryan is a Firehouse.com contributing editor, where he has multiple articles, blogs, podcasts, and has appeared in the July 2010 issue of Firehouse Magazine. Ryan is currently a West Virginia State Instructor 2, Hazmat Tech, and Certified Fire Officer 2. He is very involved teaching EMS and fire safety, or firefighter safety, and obviously you can find more about him from viewsfromthejumpseat.com. Without any further ado, Ryan, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm doing great, David. How are you?
Doing real well. Hey, thanks so much for taking the time to come on the show here. I know you just mentioned earlier before we came on the air here that you worked last night on the medic, and we know you're definitely sleep deprived at this point. Would that be correct?
That would be a correct description. If I start stumbling over my words, just kind of reach out and give me a boost. I must say that your intro is awesome. I'm pumped from the federal cues and the air horns, so I think we might be all right.
Thank you. That's the one way to wake us up and get us fired up. So
yes, sir.
So let's get rocking and rolling here. Now, one of the things you've been passionate about is this hoarding thing and really spreading the message and helping the firefighter community about, you know, just learning about this. So one of the things I wanted to know before we dive into the nuts and bolts of it was, why are you so passionate about it? Like, what got you fired up about learning about this stuff?
It kind of happened, David, over a period of time. I've had the honor of being a Firehouse.com contributing editor since 2009 and started the Views from the Jump Seat blog, which has just been an overwhelming success. But as I was running calls in our primary fire district, it started on the ambulance, and I kept noticing that these conditions were happening more often. And first thing I thought was, man, what happens if this place catches on fire, and how do we need to change how we deal with these conditions if it were to catch on fire? Well, then lo and behold, it did catch on fire. We had back-to-back hoarding fires. Then we had a hoarder fatality fire with a firefighter near miss. And having the opportunity to spread my message on Firehouse, I was like, okay, let's write an article about this. And I wrote the 380-degree size up. And during the research of that article is where I stumbled upon no one had been addressing the issue of environments caused by compulsive hoarding. And what I mean by compulsive hoarding is it is, as of 2013, is a diagnosable disorder in what they call the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Disorders that the psychologists use. So you can clinically be diagnosed as a compulsive hoarder now as of 2013. But up until I started my research, everything on this topic was from a prevention. It was from a treatment. It was from how to help them clean their homes up. Well, all those are noble causes, but I wanted to dive into how do firefighters, paramedics, EMTs, code enforcement officers, how do we need to change our tactics dealing with these situations? And of course, just like any other person with the pulse, first place you go to is Google. And when I Googled it, it was fighting fires in hoarder houses, fighting fires in Collier's mansions, tactical changes needed for hoarding. And what I found was there was zero tactical changes out there. And it just blew me away that as a fire service as a whole has known about Collier's mansions or heavy content or hoarding conditions since the 1940s, we've been dealing with it. Nobody has really taken the time to study the fire dynamic changes, the tactical changes, the stress load that you're putting your firefighters on as far as the workload and how we need to adjust. And when I teach my class, I say we need to identify, adjust, and attack hoarding issues. So that kind of got the ball rolling, and one article turned into two articles, turned into three articles, and I got the first call from Chief Pennington, no relation, in Bowers Beach, Delaware, and he called me and said, Ryan, we just had this fire. What you're writing about, we just had it. Do you have a class on this? I'm like, well, Chief, no. He's like, well, you need to write one because you're going to be come to my department and teach us the differences in fire behavior, tactical decisions. And so that kind of got the ball rolling in Bowers Beach, Delaware. And since then, we've went from a 90-minute session to a four-hour session. Now we're at 6 to 8 hour session. We've done two hands-on classes, which, wow, it just blows your mind that the tactical changes, the overloaded firefighters, the overworked firefighters, that comes from this class. And in 2013, I think we hit 850 firefighters from Southern California to the Atlantic provinces of Canada who has attended my hoarder fire class. And one of the questions that keeps coming back up is, Ryan, why do we need this class? We've been dealing with this since the 1940s. Well, yeah, we have been dealing with it, but what is happening is the research can't really specifically identify why, but these conditions and this compulsion is a growing issue, not only in the United States, but Canada, Australia, and especially in Europe is seeing a huge outbreak of compulsive hoarding.
Outstanding. Now, was there a story you were telling me, and it might have been someone else, but I thought you were saying where you had either a fireman, you know, have an LODD or had a close call or something due to hoarding?
Sure.
Can you talk about that?
Well, I'm sorry, Dave.
Can you talk about that? Share that with us, that story?
Yeah. So reaching out into the research and starting the investigating the tactical changes with this, I really didn't know where to start because no one has ever studied fire dynamics. And I know flow paths are a big key term that we're using now. And we're learning how when we open a door, close a door, and how those dynamics change. But in the process of researching this topic, what I have been finding is the stacks of debris inside the home has been changing the fire dynamics. And the way I found this is I set my Google alerts for hoarder fires or cluttered conditions. And every time one of these Google alerts come up, I try to reach out to that fire department. Well, it happened about 2 weeks ago that the Fort Wayne, Indiana firefighters went to a normal Cape Cod style house, first line made the push through the front door, started experiencing some heavy content conditions, and the firefighters' legs went down through the floor. They were able to extricate him there, kind of stand up on the debris for what it sounds like that was stacked in the basement. They went to a defensive posture and identified the heavy contents, and that was a near miss. We had a near miss here in my city where a firefighter fell through the floors. And during this research, and something that keeps coming up as a common problem between this is extended burn times, burn floor joists, because these fires have been undiscovered for as long as 8, 10, 12 hours.
Wow.
So that's just two cases. I mean, I could fill up 4 hours worth of near miss firefighter fatalities. And here's the problem is that we really don't know how bad this problem is, because on your NIFRS reports and on your fire reports, there's no section that says extensive clutter, heavy contents, hoarding. So we really haven't been studying how prevalent or how often we're dealing with these situations. It's just kind of a guess. But now you can go back and research the line of duty deaths, and there's no common terminology between them. So I spend hours and hours and hours and digging. And what I found during this is they'll use the words cluttered and blocked means of entrance and egresses. And what the eerie part about it is, it's not the clutter that has killed most of the firefighters. It's the rapid changing, deteriorating conditions, and the firefighters have not been able to get out. Because think about it, if you're crawling into these environments and you don't have a secondary means of egress, stuff goes bad, then you're pretty much stuck.
Yeah. It's, I mean, from my personal experience, it seems like most of the fires that I've been on over the years, at least half have been this excessively, I guess, compulsive, heavy content situation. Now, whether they're classified as hoarders or not, I'm not sure. But I can tell stories of one. I remember being on a doing a search, and obviously it's dark, smoke conditions, heavy fire, you know, fire. It's a structure fire, probably a two-story colonial house. And I remember crawling through, and I was like this very narrow path, and I thought I was actually in like a storage room, and stuff was falling on me and flopping around. And later on, after the fire, going back and doing like a review of it, it was actually magazines and stuff like that stacked 4 feet tall. The whole bedroom was loaded with these magazines and stacked, and that's what stuff was falling on me and flaking around. But it was just amazing. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe people live like this. I can't believe this is even possible. And so sometimes as firefighters, we're going into the situation for the first time ever and not even realizing that people actually live like this. Like I never saw something like that before. That was like one of the first times. I was like, man, but you know, more and more experience you get, you see more and more people with it. But for the up and coming firefighter, you got to realize that a lot of people don't live like we're used to living. And especially in lower socioeconomical areas, these are some things that you're just like, wow, sometimes we're shocked that people live like this. And I think that with reality TV, with some of those shows and there's shows like this with how to, they're treating hoarders and things like that. You go through and they show video of how they're living. And you're like, my goodness, I can't believe people can live like that. And some of the things they do to help people recover from that type of, I guess they call it a disease or a mental disease or whatever. But
disorder.
Yeah, disorder. So as we can dive more into this, let's kind of switch over to more of, as firefighters, as officers on the ground, how can we, what are the, like the top 3 to 5 things we need to know to best be prepared for this situation? Obviously, we only got a half hour to cover this stuff. We can't go into an 8-hour course, but can you give us, we want to break it into some simple bite-sized pieces here so we can get an overview on what we can do today to know if we get called later today, we'll know, at least have some kind of skills of how to handle it. So what do you think is the most important thing we need to realize in going into a fire that potentially has this type of environment?
Dave, number one, we need to start by kind of, and I'm going to say this with a term of endearment, pull our head out of the sand and realize that these conditions are everywhere. During the research into this topic, this is not a poor problem. This is not an American problem. It's not a black, white, Puerto Rican, Asian. It covers all racial demographics. It covers all social economic levels. You can find hoarder hounds in million-dollar homes, and you can find them in tents that are in your area. That this is classified as a disorder, and the afflicted can be rich, poor, whatever. It crosses borders. There's no defining variables, so anybody can be afflicted by it. But so first and foremost, we need to get our head out of the sand, and we need to start looking in our first two areas and start pre-fire planning hoarding conditions. Now, when I say this, I'll give you a couple of Ryan's quick tips. Number one, drive in your area. All of us know that 123 Main Street looks like a heavy content environment. And I use the word heavy content because it's a little bit more politically correct, but it's also a little bit more descriptive of the firefighter's turn. It's a heavy content environment. Dr. G helped me come up with that. And the reason that we use heavy content is for that trigger term to think that the structure's overloaded before the first drop of water has been sprayed on it. So we need to start identifying these properties around our first due district. We need to start pre-fire planning. Most of the time they're discovered on assistance calls, medical calls. You need to put some sort of a reporting system in there and even pre-fire plan them. I think that's where we drop the ball a lot in the fire service is we don't pre-fire plan enough. And you need to add a hoarding just like you would a multifamily residence or a high hazard industrial area. These hoarder homes need to be pre-fire planned.
All right, awesome. Now, what's another thing that we can do after we, so in other words, obviously we're going to go around, know our district, identify those certain houses that we need to be aware of. We can't go in and tell them to clean it up or anything. So what's something like, okay, so we have identified that this house has that potential, or we actually get there on a fire and we realize, man, this has got heavy content, or some of the first crews in say, hey, we got heavy content in here, heavy fire load, things like that. What's some of the next steps we need to do tactically?
We need to add the heavy content to your initial size up. So whatever your initial size up, acronym, COLWAS Wealth, RECOV, you need to add the terminology heavy content to your response. And I'll give you a quick example. This is Engine 1 arriving on the scene, 123 Main Street. We have a story and a half wood frame construction. We've got fire show inside C level 1, and we have a potential for a heavy content environment. Well, at that point, that needs to be broadcast. When I teach my class, I say a firefighter says what, an officer says what, chief says what, and dispatch says what. So if I'm a firefighter experiencing heavy content, hey, captain, we're experiencing a heavy content environment. Officer says received. Chief, this is a heavy content environment. The chief echoes it to the dispatcher. Dispatcher announces it to all units. And what you accomplish by doing that is you've pretty much identified that this is not a bread and butter fire anymore. This puts us a little bit more defensive. We realize that the tactics need to start changing. And that the worst case scenario is what if you're wrong? What if it's not a heavy content environment? Nothing really happens. It just means that you're going to dial back the aggressiveness just a little bit. And then once you hear that announcement of the heavy content environment, I always say the rule of doubles. If you've got a four-person first due fire crew making an eight-person, 8, 16, 16, 32, because once you go into these heavy content environments, the work time and workload is going to be increased. Your work time is going to be shortened. Your air consumption is going to be increased. And the amount of people that you're going to need to handle this situation. Prince George County, Maryland took 100 firefighters to put out basically a 3,500 square foot home with double entrapment. Where could you get 100 firefighters in rural West Virginia? Well, you're not. So you need to start thinking about, number one, going defensive and using the transitional attack and not committing firefighters to the interior. And now I'm not saying don't go in them, because as you and I spoke in the show prep here, it was like we can't let a small trash can fire in a hoarding condition go to where it burns down the block. I'm not saying that you can't go in to hoarding fires, but you need to start identifying it and realizing that if you're that firefighter making that push, and it was your story was spot on about the magazines, and how do you explain and train that firefighter to know when to say when making the push?
Yeah.
So how far in that home that you were describing with the magazines did you go? And while you were going in there, did you identify that this is, hey, chief, this is a potential heavy content environment? And then at what point would it take for you to stop? And that's what I'm finding in this research is, hey, Ryan, we ran this hoarder fire. And, man, I crawled right over top of those piles of stuff. And I got to the dragon's tongue and ripped it out and pulled out my sword and rah, rah, rah. And I'm like, whoa, partner.
Yeah.
Number one, we don't crawl over stacks of belongings. We don't know what it is. The horror stories come out with, I think it was on the West Coast, the fire captain busted down the first front door, crawled over a stack of belongings, and it was a stack of glass collapsed under him. His regulator came out. I mean, just the horror story. So we don't go over top of stacks of belongings, and we need to teach our firefighters when we're making the push to identify these conditions.
Yeah, it's so true that what you're saying is identify. Now, again, it goes back to the logic, because this is years ago for me where we just dealt with it. It just was another thing that we deal with like anything else. And so at this point, to be aware of it and then to communicate it in the BIR or the initial 360 that this is a heavy content fire or potential of a heavy content fire, it does. It changes the thinking process and tactical decisions that go into that. At least when you're going in, instead of going into a bedroom thinking, hey, this is a storage room or is there a kid in there or whatever, or is it just beds or whatever the stuff is, especially in the dark, it's really trying to identify what's going on and knowing, is it worth the risk, right? When we're getting back to risk versus reward and making those decisions. So agree with you. Great way to bring it up and just making us aware and great stuff. So,
and in teaching these guys to know when to say when. I mean, we have this discussion over social media all the time. And I ask them, I was like, how do you know when the fire is too hot? And the responses is traditionally, well, when my ears are burning. Mm-hmm. And here's the problem about the heavy content environment. And I'll put a disclaimer out there. I don't know the answer with any type of scientific research yet. Okay. But we've been in burn situations two times in heavy content environments with documented floor temperatures of 120 degrees with overhead temperatures of 3, 4, 5, 600 degrees. And these stacks of belongings have been offering shielding from the heat. And this is a double-folded problem to me. Number one, if an occupant can find an air pocket, they could survive longer inside of hoarding conditions because they're actually being shielded from the heat and the byproducts. Only problem about that is finding the fresh air. And number two, imagine that first due firefighter making the stretch down a hallway. And if you go back to filling your ears being the only reason or what your primary means of assessment is, your ears aren't going to be burning at 140 degrees and all of a sudden you've got ceiling temperatures just boiling up and just ready to go somewhere. And then if a flashover, burnover, or a rapid fire phenomenon happens, you don't have nowhere to go. So
yeah, so true. That is, it's a whole other discussion of when to know when. And obviously the face piece is going to fail around that 500 degree temperature where, you know, you come up or you go too high or that heat, the thermal layers, you know, start breaking down or coming a lot closer to the floor and over sun you're exposed. And that's where a lot of these close calls and unfortunate events start happening. So yeah, without a doubt, it's knowing our gear and knowing when. Now, when for you, is it time to say when, you know, especially in a heavy content fire?
A lot of people teach penciling the ceiling. Mm-hmm. So if you got cold droplets coming back down, you've got the molecules of water breaking into steam is another thing. Thermal imaging camera is a must. Mm-hmm. If you identify a heavy content environment, I'm not really thermal imaging is a tool in the toolbox. And this goes to my next point, David, kind of keep going right along is search tactics inside hoarder environments. In the last 60 to 90 days, we've had 9 civilian fatalities, 3 firefighters burn, and 1 firefighter close call in hoarding conditions in the North American continent. And what this comes back to is either it's a hidden hoarder where you can't tell from the outside, or they don't start changing tactics. And some of these firefighters being burnt have been directly attributed to searching for trapped occupants. 3 or 4 or 5 of them have successfully performed these rescues, which is great. But unfortunately, the patients didn't make it. And so this kind of takes me on to my next topic, and that's going towards search tactics. If you go in a hoarder home and do your right or left-hand search in hoarding conditions, where do you think you're going to end up? It's not going to be the wall. Mm. You're going to find yourself right in the middle of these homes and be so turned around that you don't find your way out. So what I'd recommend with searching is go away from the right and left-hand search. Use an oriented search with either a search rope. I highly recommend a search rope, a thermal imaging camera, and someone who's directing the search who stays oriented to the location of the firefighters, period. And when I say search rope, I don't mean a piece of nylon rope that we get from Lowe's down here that I see sometimes, because if you're dragging this nylon rope over smoldering hoarding stacks, what's the chances of that thing melting and going through? So I recommend the high heat search ropes. We're on you're trying to sell products. We can't afford to buy high heat search ropes. Yep, maybe you can't, but I guarantee you that you carry something on your fire truck that's double jacketed and has about 600 feet of it. Take an uncharged line with you instead of a piece of nylon rope when you're doing these search tactics. Use the oriented firefighter, oriented directed, and go away from the left and right hand search tactics.
And use the camera. Most people have cameras, obviously. And if you don't, then you're referring back to the hose. So great.
Yeah. The sleep deprivations get me, Dave. Thanks. Yeah. But if you put your thermal imaging camera on there, you need to realize in these fires we're crawling into nowadays, look at the smoke. When I first started, the smoke was light gray. Now it went to thick gray. Now it's almost blacked out conditions. Don't rely on that thermal imaging camera to tell you where you're at. Keep your bearings. I'm at a doorway. I'm at the hallway and go through that and use that search rope. Now, a lot of people come back and say, hey, Ryan, well, that search rope's going to knock over debris and it could cover up things. Yes, this is a training evolution that everybody should add to your department's drilling. Here's the problem, or here is a benefit of taking a 400 square foot room and choking it down to pathways. These occupants can actually be easier to find, but immensely harder to remove. Because think about it, if you're searching, if you would lay out a theater and you put a victim in one of the aisles to search, those firefighters are going to get led right to them because you can't crawl over the seats. You're going to go right down the aisleway and find them. Now, once you found them, getting them out is going to be a completely different story.
Great, great, great idea. So what's another thing that we need to be aware of?
Overhaul in hoarder fires could quite potentially be the most dangerous time when you're dealing with overloaded structures. I always ask people in my class, how much does a pound of water weigh? Well, it weighs 1 pound. Well, no, it's 8.33 pounds per gallon times however gallons that you've added to this house full of contents that most likely are going to absorb what you just threw in there, like the magazines and books. Mm-hmm. So when you switch from a offensive or defensive tactics going into overhaul, first and foremost, you need to go start popping some holes and looking for some, inspecting the structural members. I've had two cases where two firefighters say, hey, Cap, this floor feels spongy. Okay, that's enough. Everybody out. And what they found was the floor joists had been burned all the way through, and the floor was actually resting on the hoarded belongings in the basement. Mm. So when you're switching from a active firefight into overhauling, you need to go in there, pop you some holes. We've got dilapidated structures that have had dilapidation issues from water damage, from overloaded structure problems, and then you've got the burn, extended burn times, and we just need to be more cautious during overhaul, wearing your SCBA longer, because if you knock over a stack of smoldering debris, you get a big face full of hydrogen cyanide and CO. So we wear our SCBAs longer. The number one thing that you need to remember with all this hoarding stuff is protect your firefighters. The number one killer of firefighters, I always say, is cheeseburgers, because I love cheeseburgers.
That's right.
But it's stress-induced issues. And when you're in the overhaul phase of a fire, that's when you're worn down from the firefight. You've been through rehab multiple times. You're in a hurry to get back to the station. All the adrenaline's gone because the fire's out. So you need to be more cautious and watch your firefighters closer during this time.
Outstanding. Now, I've seen where, you know, just watching some of the reality TV and the investigative reports and stuff on these types of folks that live like this, is that the people that actually go in when they're doing these interventions and trying to help them, the area, the air in the houses are so toxic, and the bacteria from just the stuff sitting there year after year, and food and animals, if they have animals, and the feces and things like that, that it's just so toxic that they actually go in with BA and respirators and stuff when they're cleaning out that environment. Have you seen that too? So I guess coming back to overhaul, we should be keeping our BA on, not only for the fire conditions or the smoke and the cyanide and the carbon monoxide, but all the other elements that just would kill, you know, affect our lungs and stuff without the fire conditions. Is that accurate or not really?
It's very accurate. I started this research to protect firefighters. What I found was the most vulnerable members of emergency services are going to be your EMS crews. It's going to be your police officers, because we always, as firefighters, carry SCBAs in. And since I started researching this topic, I've expanded teaching this class to building managers, to utility workers, to EMS providers, and you were spot on. The airborne, aerosolized mold, the Hanta virus, is a rodent spread, non-curable disease that when they were filming the TLC show in Houston, they thought they had 31 people exposed to it. And if I read it correctly, I'm still learning a whole lot about some of these things, is the Hanta virus won't really affect you and I, but it's communicable to our children. Mm. Wow. Mm. That is something. So you've got aerosolized molds. One of the most interesting and disgusting ones I've ever been into was a ferret hoarder. Wow. So we're going in there, and I highly recommend, if you discover a heavy content environment, you do not go in there with anything less than an N95 respirator. And I won't even start to spend time on the ammonia levels created by decaying fecal matter from animals, because I've got documented cases of ammonia levels at 300 parts per million when OSHA describes a dangerous environment at 35 parts per million. So, and then you come into another whole issue, and that is dealing with the occupant with an SCBA on. It reminds me of that Marty McFly movie, I am Darth Vader, from the planet Vulcan. And that person already has deep emotional attachment to their belongings, and you walk in with their BA on, and I mean, that is a whole nother radio show, is that interaction, because these folks have been living in it, and to them it's quote unquote normal. And here you've gone in with your SCBA, your coveralls, and your boots to protect you from all this stuff. You've got to interact with the patients, which is challenging, to say the least.
Yeah, so, and just as for the guys that are listening to that, are EMTs or paramedics or chiefs and captains of the department, is to get this message out to their EMS side, because, again, for those folks that are walking in, a lot of times you're walking in with just your pants, a sweatshirt, right, your whatever your regular uniform on, and not thinking, and then now you're getting exposed to all these different things that you mentioned. So they're at least when we enter a fire, we should have all our PPE and SCBA on, and then keeping that on throughout overhaul, but being aware as if we run on EMS runs or we're doing lifting assist calls and stuff like that, and going into these environments that, you know, not only does it smell bad and we're going to be affected temporarily, we can have long-term effects, and then bringing it back to our kids. So it's a very serious condition and something that we definitely got to get note of. And that's why you're passionate about it. And I'm glad you're sharing. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Dave.
Anything I'm missing here? Or should we go on to more stuff? What's another key thing? Cause I know you have tons of it, but is there something else that we desperately should know about this?
We need to realize, and I don't know how to say this with being tactfully say this, we need to realize that as a whole, as firefighters, EMT, and I'll add another demographic that I never really thought about, who we need to reach out to offer these suggestions to, and it's our utility workers. Mm-hmm. Who goes into more homes than the cable guy?
That's right.
I mean, we need to make that a two-way street. Let the cable guy report the conditions to us, and we need to train the meter readers and the people go into these homes on how to protect themselves from the biohazards and stuff. So that would be a double-edged sword. But most importantly, these people who are afflicted with hoarding disorders don't choose to live this way. While their compulsion can start from the collection, it is a psychological disorder now diagnosable, and we need to realize that this is somebody's mother, brother, sister, and treat them respectfully. That's kind of hard sometimes if you're worrying about a life or death situation. I mean, we don't have time to explain, Miss Johnson, that your house is on fire. We're going to grab Miss Johnson by the neck or by her coat sleeves or whatever and drag her out of there, because these people have such compulsion and affliction to their belongings. So we need to understand that the human aspects of hoarding. Another reason that I chose this topic is I have a family member who is afflicted with compulsive hoarding disorder. I love them very much, and I would be very upset if a first responder would go in there and say, this is the filthiest, trashiest place I've ever seen. Won't you clean this place up? Or Mr. So-and-so and so-and-so, this is filthy and disgusting and wretched and everything. We need to keep the human aspects of this disorder on the forefront of our minds, that we're there to help the people. We want to explain to them and take the life and death conditions out of it, like in a medical call. Mm-hmm. We need to understand that we need to treat them to like they're our family, because they might be.
Yeah, so true. Well, outstanding. I want to try and summarize. I took some notes because this is some great stuff you're sharing. Go ahead. I'm sorry. You're going to say something? Ryan?
Oh, no.
I just want to sum up then. So just to refresh here. So number one, the first tip is to do pre-fire planning for these types of situations for folks that are heavy or properties that have heavy content. Is a way that we can use the terminology, but obviously driving the neighborhoods, obviously knowing our first due, and we're doing EMS and medical calls to identify that stuff, and then include it in a BIR and let even if it's just a simple refresher training type thing or a 1-hour course of letting people know these types of hazards and what they're up against within your department, and then adding that to the BIR or the 360 that, hey, this has a potential to be a heavy content fire, so that code word knows what we're all against and what we could be potentially facing here. Another one is to know when to say when. How deep are we going into the fire? What kind of risk are we taking? Because it's even with all the risk that we normally have in a fire situation, this is now almost doubling the risk and doubling the different things that could go wrong and causing more close calls or LODDs. And what are we really risking here? The next is a search tactics to really get away from doing the right hand or left hand search tactic and get more into using and determining that up front, hey, this is a heavy content fire. We're going to do a search. We're going to use a search line, a high heat search line, a hose line, using our cameras and making sure that we're not climbing over items because we don't know what those items are or what's underneath those items. And next would be when we're overhauling, after the situation, overhauling, make sure that it's still a very dangerous time. There's so much more than just the normal toxins that we're dealing with. There's all the other toxins like the ammonia and things like that. So we should be keeping our BA on. I'd kind of recommend keeping the BA on all the time because usually most departments aren't going to have the respirators. I believe you're recommending the N5 respirator as the minimum, but most of us don't. So at least we have the BA, which is a better quality, and we're breathing our air, and it's free. It's our air, so use it and protect ourselves because the last thing we want to do is go home and infect our children and have them come down with a serious illness or death. Because we transferred the illness or toxins to them. Would that pretty much sum it up, or is there some things that I missed?
No, that would sum it up. That's the short and long of it, I guess. Yeah. One other thing that I would add that has been really prevalent is incident commanders knowing when to write the building off and tear it down because it's not worth going inside. And some of these decisions have come with people still inside them. I can think of a case just outside of Pittsburgh, a case in Michigan, where they knew that they had occupants in there. There was a case in Illinois that had two people in the basement. And it comes to the point, or it needs to come to the point, where those people are gone and we're not going to risk any more firefighter lives to go in there. And they actually had to tear the building down around some of it have been actually still in actual fire conditions. So pre-fire planning to know where your demolition companies are, working with your demolition companies with hand signals and such. So that way, if this situation does arise, which it does arise, where you have to tear the building down, even with the occupants still inside, that we can recover the family members for them.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. And again, this interview here, thanks for taking the time and sharing, is not a comprehensive, this is all you need to know. This is really just an awareness to start thinking about these things and being aware of it, that, man, this is pretty serious and we should be having some classes in our fire departments and in our counties or mutual aid departments and things like that, and having some kind of code language like heavy content. So this is just really an introduction, and obviously Ryan's teaching, 8-hour courses and stuff like that on this stuff. So there's no way we can get it all in 30 minutes. But Ryan, for folks that want to learn more or want to bring this stuff into their department or want to do some training, where can they reach out to you and get some more information?
Sure, Dave. The website is called chamberofhoarders.com. It's just common spelling, chamberofhoarders.com. You can email me at jumpseatviews@icloud.com. And I might be a little bit of a Twitter-holic, so hit us up on Twitter at jumpseatviews. That's about it. Check us out on firehouse.com, and hopefully we'll get some more stuff to you, David, so we can keep spreading the word. Firefighting in Canada, I'm writing an article series on hoarder fires. We started with Can You Go In Them? Next one's going to be Searching In Them. And also, I really would like to get out there that the Chamber of Hoarders, I realize that not all departments, because of budgetary concerns, can bring me in to speak, because traveling is just so expensive. So I recorded my 4-hour version, and you can find that at Chamber of Hoarders. So if you're a firefighter looking to go through a 4-hour training session, it's reasonably priced at $29.99, and departments, we can do it for $5 a member with a 20-member minimum. And this is just an introductory price. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to raise the prices eventually because the technology that it takes to record these videos is getting higher and higher. We're going to have a DVD series coming out. I've got the book almost written. Fighting Fires in Hoarder Houses, the book is coming out. I'm hoping right around my birthday, maybe August 19th, I can get it out. So it'll be the first book ever written on fighting fires and in emergency response and hoarding conditions. We've got some informational packets coming out for the fire prevention officers to help the family members out there. And I think that's it.
Well, hey, thanks so much for doing the work and the research and, you know, having your hand on or your finger on the pulse of this so we can learn from it and hopefully save our butts from it and not have not get ourselves in the jackpot kind of thing. And so it's nice to know that you're doing this and just kind of feed us the stuff we need to know and get us up to speed on this so we can protect ourselves and those around us. So thanks so much for your doing. Thanks for coming on the show. And, you know, obviously keep up the good work.
Oh, thank you, David. Love the website. Love your contributors. You've really made a great landing place for us firefighters to gather information and learn. It's very engaging. Your Facebook posts, your Twitter posts, I really enjoy it.
Hey, thanks so much. And again, we're just here to serve. We want to get the word out, and we feel again that to be great firefighters, we got to continue to train, continue to learn, continue to stay, and continue to evolve because this. The ever-changing skill of firefighting, you know, what it was 5-10 years ago is different than it was today, and it's going to be different 5 or 10 years from now. So we have to be committed and disciplined to continue to evolve and continue to learn, and we just want to make it fun and interactive and as easy as possible. So thanks so much for the compliments there, and thank you for listening and staying and being a part of the Firefighter Toolbox Nation here and family. So we'll be back next week again, next Tuesday, for another episode. And again, as you know, we have an article, a new article every day being released on the website. And if you're not on the insiders list, you'll want to get on that. We will be doing different events and webinars and training. A lot of this stuff is going to be free, but we're going to announce it on the insiders list. So there's no spam. It's nothing like that. It's just really for us to know that you're raising your hand saying, you know, I want to train, I want to learn, and I want to know what you guys are up to. Send me the stuff. And that's what we're doing here. So that's the plan on air. You can go to the website and get on the list. Thanks again. Be safe out there. God bless.
Thanks for building your skills today with Firefighter Toolbox.
You're back in service. You can respond to FirefighterToolbox.com for another skill-building episode and more training resources.
Firefighter Toolbox. Firefighter Toolbox. Building better firefighters and leaders.
Firefighter, back in service.